Hello, everybody. This is William Del Pilar, and this is Fired Up, your source for conservative talk. Today, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to talk about and we are going to get you ready for the political event of the year. The politician with benefits versus the art of the deal. Kamala Harris versus Donald Trump. It's like watching a masterclass in capitalism go head to head with a PowerPoint presentation on how to politic your way to the top. Trump's coming in with the swagger of a self-made billionaire, while Kamala's got the confidence of someone who just found out what self-made means. Will it be a clash of titans or just two people trying to remember where they parked their egos? Buckle up, folks, because this is going to be a debate that's more unpredictable than a cat on a hot tin roof. Then we're going to talk about the latest jobs report. It's so bad that even the jobless are starting to form a support group. Hi, I'm Bob, and I've been unemployed since the Biden administration began. At this point, the only thing hiring is a local coffee shop for baristas to serve all the frustrated job seekers who are just trying to caffeinate their way through the day. If this report were a movie, it'd be titled The Great Job Hunt, a comedy of errors. And in other news, Act Blue is under investigation. It's like watching a magician get caught with their hand in the donation jar. Everyone's wondering how they pulled off that financial sleight of hand. Maybe they should have just stuck to fundraising bingo. At least then everyone would know where the money's going. And speaking of getting support, it seems Kamala Harris is having a tough time connecting with influencers. When even TikTok stars are ghosting you, it might be time to rethink your strategy. It's like trying to get a cat to do tricks. Good luck with that. Maybe she should consider a viral dance challenge. After all, who doesn't love a good vote for me TikTok? Now, on a more serious note, the rise in abortion rates is a heartbreaking reality. It's a reminder that behind every statistic is a personal story filled with challenges and tough choices. We need to foster a society where everyone has access to the support and resources they need to make informed decisions about their health and futures. Because at the end of the day, we all want to live in a world where compassion and understanding and life are at the forefront. Hello, everybody. Once again, this is William Del Pilar, and I am here with my co-host, G. Mangani and Annette Ross. Before we get going, let's have those two tell us a little bit about themselves. Let's start with Miss Annette.
Hello. Good evening, William and G. How are you guys doing tonight?
I'm well. Fired up.
Good. Annette Ross, I wrote the book Where Fairy Tales Go, president of the Rancho Santa Fe School Board, disability advocate, and mother of five daughters. So that should put me in some sort of a insane asylum.
Well, I wouldn't say insane asylum. That sounds like a good Catholic girl. I don't know if you're Catholic, but that's what the saying used to be. Mr. G.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say I've read a book, and that's an accomplishment. Writing one's a bigger accomplishment, so kudos to you. I'm G. Mangani. I'm a governing board member at the Rancho Santa Fe School District alongside Annette. And, I've read a book or two.
You know, I've written tens of thousands of words with articles over the years. I've always wanted to write a book, but man, that is a tough task. So kudos to you, Annette, on that. Well, let's get right into it. You know, we're going to start with a few stories here, and I want to start with the August jobs report, the great employment exaggeration, a tale of inflated numbers and future corrections. Why do I say that? Well, they came out with, what was it, G, about 800,000 job correction from the past year, but this is more your domain. So tell us a little bit about the jobs report that came out this morning.
Yeah, so the jobs report, they were expecting 160,000 jobs roughly and came out with 140,000 jobs created in the month of August, which is lower than expectation. Now, you got to keep in mind, that sounds like, wow, we're adding jobs. And, you're adding jobs, but you also have a net immigration, which means you need more jobs to keep up with immigration, and you have people retiring, falling out of the workforce. So with all that combined, the zero line is about 140,000. So where we are at for the month of August is we're at the zero line. We needed 140,000 to keep up, and we had 140,000 corrected. So what's interesting is last month you see the 89 there for the month of July. And again, September you report for August, and August you report for July. So July was revised down. I believe it was 112,000 or something like that. So where we had lost jobs in July, we lost even more jobs. And June was also further revised down. So I wouldn't be surprised if this 142,000 for August is revised down to 110,000, 100,000, which means we're losing jobs. Another thing that I saw that is very alarming, you would imagine that a healthy economy is adding full-time jobs, right? I mean, that just makes sense, right? And if you're adding more part-time jobs, that could be a healthy economy. But what's happening, and especially in August, is we lost 438,000 full-time jobs. And that was replaced with about 500,000 part-time jobs. And so that's not a good thing, because people are losing their full income, and they might be having to take one or two part-time jobs to make up that income that they've lost from their full-time position. So while they said, well, this is great news, the unemployment rate went from 4.3% down to 4.2%. Well, if you have a part-time job and you work 1 hour, you're considered employed. So that's not good news on the surface. So
and you know, I have a question on that. These numbers that are so low single digits started when Obama, there's like six categories. Correct me if I'm wrong, there's like six categories, if I remember correctly, on how they create this formula. And Obama was like at 12%. And nobody had been reelected with a unemployment percentage that high. So they shifted the formula to create this lower unemployment rate. But in essence, what you're saying is it's kind of deceiving, because somebody could have a part-time job or, like you said, work 1 hour and they're considered as part of the employment. So any idea what the true number is using the old formula?
Yeah. So the U3 is what they normally report, which is the 4.2%. But maybe a better measure of unemployment is the U6, where they add in these people who are discouraged. So if you're a discouraged worker, you're looking for a job and you can't find one, you say, okay, forget it, I'm going to take a month off and live in the basement. Well, you're counted not as employed or unemployed. You just fall off the statistics. So U6 is 7.9%. And I think that's the number you're referring to with Obama back in the day with the 12%. So we're climbing. I mean, so historically, somewhere in the 4 range is considered healthy, but it's the trend, it's the direction where we're going. And there's this indicator called the SAHM rule, S-A-H-M. And she modified this rule made in the 1960s or 70s by McIlvaney. And she modified it. So McIlvaney has some, when they're trying to predict a recession, they had some false positives. So Claudia SAHM made it so that it was harder to have a false positive, but hers now might have a false negative. So all things being said, I don't want to like bore the audience, because, you know, numbers are so fun.
I know. I think you got to give percentages to people for us laymen to understand. Gee, a couple of questions on your chart. Yeah. I see three massive jumps. Well, I have two questions. That's the first question is my thought process is some of that has got to be people coming back from COVID, you know, the opening back up. But I don't know. I'm guessing. But the other question I have is, I didn't read it, and I should have read it, but I saw a couple, more than one headline talking about there are more jobs going to non-Americans than Americans, and the inference I got was that maybe those are jobs going to more illegals than they are to the citizens. Can you comment on both those questions?
Yeah, I mean, I believe that I don't know if it's illegals or just immigrants in general. I believe that is the case because most citizens will probably demand a higher wage than someone who's, you know, fresh to this country and coming from a different lifestyle, different income range. So I absolutely believe that would be true, and that would portend that at the bottom end of labor, that they're the ones, you know, Americans or citizens are losing their jobs, right? So another indicator that I always think is if you just go out to a Starbucks, go out to McDonald's, you go out to a Wendy's, you're going to start seeing these deals, right? And they're already there, the $5 meal deal. Starbucks had this $6 for a hot coffee and a sandwich. I'm seeing that more and more everywhere. And I mean, that just goes to, you know, Home Depot came out and said the Consumer's Week. That's what's happening out there. That's real life. That's anecdotal, but it is showing up in the company numbers. And sometimes predicting a recession or that you're in one maybe takes a year. And then you say, oh, we started the recession a year ago, because a lot of these numbers come back later and they're revised. And I'll give you a quick example. So 2008, I read this article, and I read this recently. 2008, they're saying, why do people feel like the economy is so poor? All the numbers are showing that this is a booming economy. That was June 2008. And now, looking back, the recession started December 2007. So I think we're in a similar situation. Right. I think the recession started a while ago.
And real quick, the 72 off. Yes, we are live. Feel free to ask us any question. So, Gene, on these big points, is that because of COVID and jobs and the country opening back up? I mean, those are massive jumps.
Right. And, so, yeah, absolutely. Actually, they were really big in 21, I believe. But, yeah, those I think they were in the 2000 range, right, if you're looking at that graph. And Biden saying, well, you know, Trump had the worst job loss in history, and I had the greatest job gain in history. Well, of course, because everyone was told to stay home, you can't work, you lost your job. And then once everything opened up, bam, everyone went right back to work. The real number is right there where you see the 300. That's a good, healthy economy.
Okay, gotcha. Where you see like the 361, gotcha. Okay. Yeah. So my next question, G, and Annette, I'm sorry, we're kind of excluding you here a little bit. I sincerely apologize. Did you have any questions here for G or any comments on this? This is kind of like G's domain.
No, I'm so glad that you're focusing on G. Keep going.
So, Annette, what do you think of the unemployment? I'm the same boat you are, Annette. Gee, has there ever been a time, and I hate to put you on the spot, but it seems in my modern lifetime, since I became an adult and became a political junkie in the late 90s, that I can't remember ever seeing an adjusted jobs report going up. It's always going down. So has there ever been a case of this going up? And if there hasn't, and you said that this 142 is kind of like a baseline number that we needed, it seems when they adjust it, it's going to go below that, which means to me in layman terms, that would mean that the economy is not doing very good.
No, absolutely. And I can't think of one where they adjust upwards. I'm sure it's happened. But normally the adjustment is down. So you had mentioned earlier about the 818,000 revision downward, and yearly they do have that. And I believe that's March to March. So that negative 818 was March 23 to March 24, right? So it doesn't include the last few months, but that averages out to what, 70,000 lost every month. The last time we had a number that big, and I believe this number was bigger than that, it was 2009. So that was, you know what happened in 2008, 2009. We had a major recession, right? The great financial crisis, yeah.
You know, it's what irks me is it's true. You can feel the pain. You may not necessarily see it. And I get so angry at these reporters at CNN or MSNBC or Don Lemon, as people sarcastically call him, saying, well, you're wrong. The economy's doing well. And he's arguing with a guy who's living check to check, you know, who's struggling. You know, I had a friend once tell me, well, I'm in X amount of debt, William. And I said, dude, you're not living check to check. You're not hoping to be able to put food on the table or where your family's going to live a few months. Just because you have debt doesn't mean you're struggling. So, and when you're working two jobs, it's sad. It's very sad. I mean, to me, I'm not saying this is a depressing report, but gee, before we end this topic, what would you tell people in this current economy? Save your pennies, keep honey. I mean, if somebody came to you and said, gee, I need some advice on this. This is your wheelhouse. What do you recommend? What would you tell America?
Yeah, I mean, I would say if you have money to invest, I would not put in the stock market right now. I've actually been going more to cash. Hang on to your job, right? And stay where you're at for now, because when the layoffs come, and then it will increase exponentially, they pretty much get rid of the people that are new, right? So if you're an established worker where you're at, you stay where you're at, you got a good reputation where you're at, keep your job, ride this out. I mean, this might be a 16-month recession, could be 2 years, who knows? And the stock market, and we could talk about this in future shows, but a stock market is relatively valued at 200% above its fair value. If you go by the Warren Buffett indicator. So if that's true, then it has to drop 50% so that you can get back to a 10% gain every year in the stock market on average. So right now, I believe, don't get into the stock market at this point.
Well, for the working class, the closest they get to the stock market is usually their mutual fund, because their job, you know, has that set up. My final question, so I lied. I do have one more question. What's it going to take, or what's it take to get out of this situation this country is in right now? Is it killing regulations off, the government pulling back? I mean, what has to happen for this economy to start bouncing back in the right direction?
Right. So the first thing is going to be the Federal Reserve, I believe, will drop interest rates this month. And who knows how much that will be. But we need to reduce regulation, right? And a lot of the economy is just really based on people's psychology. And if they think, oh, it's too hard to do business, they won't take the risk or whatnot. So reduce regulation, I think reducing tax rates. Kamala wants to, tax unrealized gains. So that means if you own a business that's gone up in value, now you have to pony up the cash to pay taxes on the increased value. I mean, just insane ideas that are thrown out there. So, but yeah, I would say that those things is, regulation, I think, will be the biggest. Interest rates and regulation will be the biggest one.
Wow. All right. So let's move on here after that depressing news to go into more depressing news. So when Kamala took – I give Kamala credit. She was not the Democrat Party's go-to girl when they kicked Biden to the side. She was smart enough to grab the bull by the horns and take control of the situation. And she managed to raise like $300 million, you know, or like $100 million like the first week. And most of it was through ActBlue. And I'm scratching my head. I'm like, that's as close to a statistical impossibility as you can get based on how the system's set up. And sure enough, there were a lot of undercover reports out there. And it's all legal. I mean, it's all public information. Citizen journalists were just looking at this paperwork, knocking on doors, and people were like, no, I haven't donated 200 times in the last 6 months to the Democrat Party. I mean, stories like that. And it took citizen journalism to get Republicans, attorney generals of various states, because the Democrats won't touch us. And that irks me. because it just shows how corrupt our system. If this was the other way around and if it was Win Red, I'd still want it investigated. Because my issue is we're in a class warfare, not a tribal warfare like they want us to have. But anyway, Republicans, AGs are investigating ActBlue for potential donation loopholes. ActBlue raised over $300 million for Harris in the second quarter of 2024. There are concerns about the verification process. In essence, it's a corrupt system. Annette, let's start with you. First of all, there's no CVV verification. That's that number at the behind your credit card. I don't know how it works. I always find it silly. I'm like, they want that verification number, but if they're able to hack in, they're going to be able to get that verification number anyway. But that's become a key issue in this. In essence, it's compromised the integrity of campaign financing. What do you see as a potential risk and benefits of one, not getting this under control, and two, we get it under control, what can happen? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm honestly would love to ask a couple questions to you or to G, because I'm very perplexed by this. And what do you guys surmise is actually going on? That is what I'm... What do you think is happening? That was confusing to me.
Well, for me, it's simple. Most people don't realize. I forget what percentage. Like 60 or 70% of murders go unsolved. Mm-hmm. We have this belief that we solve most of the issues out there, and the truth of the matter is, fraud is. And I use murder as an analogy because most people don't realize that it's the same thing with fraud. Fraud is rampant, and especially with technology, it can be hacked into. Identities can be used. That's why they have mailer voter registrations. You know, mail those ballots in. You don't get that person to person, and it's easy to play the system. So it's easy to get somebody's name and then reuse it over and over because somebody has to be looking for that to find the corruption. If nobody's looking for it, you're going to be able to keep doing it. And in politics, it seems for some reason that politics tends to be off limits in seeking that corruption out. That's how I kind of see it, where it's like the big boys are at play and us little people aren't allowed in the game. So they're allowed to do what they please until it gets to the point it's so ridiculous that even we little people notice it and we bring it to their attention. I think in a nutshell, that's what's happening. G, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine that a lot of this money came from big donors, but they can only give so much to a particular candidate, right? So you have to have some way of spreading it out. So I would imagine that maybe on paper, that's what it looks like, right? It's saying G-Man Ghani, and I don't donate to ActBlue, but G-Man Ghani gave $1,000 when I didn't give it a thing, right? But on paper, they could say, okay, this is what he gave, but really that came from a George Soros and he put this money into a pile. So that's what it looks like to me. I would hope that they're not actually taking someone who put in a $5 donation and charge them 10 times for a $50 donation.
Oh, well, they're not charging them. They're not charging them. They're just, it's money. Duh. I'm an idiot. It's money laundering. It's a sophisticated form of money laundering. They're using, with money laundering, you use a business that isn't making any money or they don't care how much money. They're not trying to make money with a business, but they're using the illegal money and that business is saying, hey, this is the money we made as a business. That's what they're using the people for. So Joe Schmuckatelli, that's why he doesn't know he's giving $200 a month. You know, this is under the radar. And unless you're looking for this, you're not going to find it. But theoretically, we have – What's the term? We have flags in place, meaning a red flag will pop up in the algorithm if something is off. But they don't have those checks and balances in ActBlue. And I would imagine they probably don't have them in WinRed. I mean, why would they want to self-police? You know, these are people of power, of wealth. It's like G said, it's not Mr. Joe Schmuckatelli. giving $200 a month. It's Soros giving it, or somebody like Soros giving it, and they're just using their name. And that's what's happened here. So when I heard that, what was it, Gia? Was it like $100 million in like 3 days or 4 days she raised? Yeah. And I'm like, yeah. No way. There's just no freaking way that, especially in this economy, you know, there's not to mention, let's take Kamala. She got a massive boost from young women who are no different than young men living at home in the basement, you know? Where are they going to get this money? So there were so many common sense questions, but people are like, well, show me the proof. And we can't. So it takes the AG to open an investigation, but they have to have something to go on. So I guess these AGs must have found something to go on. For example, a single donor made 443 separate donations of $2.50 each in 1 day. I mean, these are just statistically, this doesn't happen. And another donor made 1,065 separate donations of $5 each within 24 hours. So it's a scam. It's a con. It's a fraud. And I think politics has become so corrupt and so open, mm-hmm. and we become so tribalistic. So, for example, if you attack this, well, you're attacking Kamala. She's a woman, and you're a racist for trying to sit there and say she can't raise this kind of money. That's how bad our corruption has become, and that's how blatant it is, to the mm-hmm. point that they just don't care. It's kind of like you're saying, yeah, we know we're doing it. Prove it. That's kind of what's happening here with AdBlue.
I have two things to say about that, William. Number one would be, is it worth it, the investigation? And I would say that honestly, being fair, would you honestly say that there's not something like that happening on the other side as well? That
oh, no. This is night and day. This is everything's flipped.
Do you really you think so?
Oh, yeah. It's in terms of the amount of money and how much money is raised. Yeah. See, people don't realize the parties have kind of switched. The Republican mm-hmm. Party is kind of for the working man. Big corporations, big mega billionaires, they're all for the Democrat Party. And the uber rich Republicans are more democratically aligned because they want that cheap labor. You know, people don't realize the Chamber of Commerce at the national level does not work for business people. They work for the corporations who want to import cheap labor. So, yes, the money has become so rampant, it has to stop. It's okay to have a legal system that has checks and balances. I'm okay with mm-hmm. corporations donating. I'm okay with billionaires donating. But it's got to be on the up and up, and we need to know where the money's coming from. And the reason I say that is you're never, never going to change money and power and politics and taxes. And people don't realize before Reagan took over, our taxes were up for 70%, depending on how rich you were. But these rich people, and I'm not knocking them, we would do the same thing. They have good accountants who are able to find the loopholes, move their money around. So they never truly paid it. And my point is we have to have some kind of check and balance because money is the root of all evil. And this is power. This is money that can get bad people elected. For example, in Colorado was a red state that the fundamentalists went too far to the right. And it became purple quickly. Then it became blue. The Democrats were tired of the Democrat Party. They thought they were incompetent. So three billionaires and a guy worth about $450 million, they started pumping money into all this race. It was all legal. I'm not knocking it. But I'm saying there was one race that was the equivalent of a dog catcher. The Republican opponent spent like $20,000, you know. The Democrats spent $1.6 million and won the race by a couple of votes. That's how much they wanted to retake or they wanted to take control. So, yes, this has – I don't want to say stop. It has to be brought under control. I have no issues with people wanting to give their money to candidates. I have issues when it's done illegally. So, for example, with Obama, he had tens of millions in dark money, which is illegal. Everybody knew it, but nobody wanted to get on Obama's bad side and be called a racist or be seen in the tribalistic views. That's why I got into the politics. I'm mm-hmm. like, we're Americans. We're pitting each other just based off of skin or religion or gender or whether you're gay or straight. We're making it personal. And in the meantime, they use these battles to do a lot of evil. In Obama's case, it was a lot of dark money, tens of millions, you know, and that does tilt the playing field. That does allow a Democrat candidate to have more walkers than Republicans, you know, and knocking on doors. I mean, people don't understand how far that money goes and where it goes, and Democrats are very good at that. Gee, you have any comments on that? I kind of blathered on there. Sorry.
No, I mean, I think back to Biden saying, let's do the debate in June, right? I'm a little conspiratorial about this, but I think that was a plan by people who wanted Biden out. And so they had a plan to make Biden, I mean, they already knew that he was hurting mentally, right? So they knew he was not going to perform well. They had a plan to get Kamala in there. They had a plan of how are they going to get all this money, because they got to start a campaign with 3-4 months to go. So I think this was just part of that plan, is how do we get all this money, like I said, from these big rich donors and fund the Kamala campaign. I did see on Facebook, I'm friends with Whitney Tilson, and he was a hedge fund manager. Sometimes he's on CNBC. And I remember back in early July, he was making posts on Facebook saying, I got to get my rich friends to stop donating to Joe Biden. And the only thing I could think of is, okay, well, I guess money talks in politics, and he's just proving it right here. I'm not going to give Biden my money. And the moment Kamala was swapped in, then all of a sudden he said, everyone needs to give their money, right? So money does talk in these campaigns. And they had to figure out, how could they give $1 million? How could one person give $1 million without breaking the law? Well, you can get a bunch of people who gave $1,000, right?
Oh, and Annette, look at it this way. You're on the school board. Most school boards are dominated by leftist progressives. And why is that? And why doesn't the Republican Party invest in school board? Exactly. The unions will spend $500,000 on their candidate, and there's the conservative candidate who just wants the kid to learn math, arithmetic, and doesn't want to learn, hey, this is how you peel a banana and put a condom on. You know, they're struggling to raise a few thousand. And so that's a great example there of the evil of money. You know, it's being, and it's not the fact that the unions, what I'm trying to say is a lot of people in the unions wouldn't want their money used that way as it is. But my point is, it's the overwhelming amount of money that's there. Arnold Schwarzenegger, the unions castrated him because Schwarzenegger thought when he was doing those three propositions back 20 years ago, he could just smile, wave his arm, show his face, I'm the governor. But the unions went after him and spent like 300 some odd million and defeated him. They literally castrated him because that was the turning point from Schwarzenegger being the lovable conservative to becoming all of a sudden a climate post-green type advocate, because he didn't want to deal with the unions. And those are some of the evils of money. I don't care about money if it's a fair race. Everything's done on the up and up. But when an FEC records show 22,000 instances of donors exceeding their contribution limits, that's a massive red flag. I mean, because statistically, you're always going to have a give and take. And, you know, I forget the term. Maybe G knows it. But, you know, there's a certain amount that, this much over, this much under, you know, that's acceptable. These are unacceptable. And we're talking money that can literally turn a race. So that's my issue. And it's like mafiosa. I think that's what bugs me about all this. The mafia is like, damn, boy, I wish we could be like the government, you know? these are killers. These are people who launder money, who make money through cons, through grifts, through illegalities. And here's the government saying, hold my beer. Let me show you how it's done. And they get away with it. I think that's what bugs me, is they get away with it and they're not held to the same standards as we are. You know, hell, even when they are convicted, they get to go to their little country club type prison versus I'm like, put them in the general population. But that's my thought on it. I take it you don't think it's that big of a deal, though, Annette?
No, that's not it. No, I think it's so corrupt. I don't know how you beat it. And I guess one of the ways you can beat it is by enlightening people that it's happening. And then they're more aware. They're paying more attention to it. I feel like, there's a race out here. We have a congressperson, Democrat. I think her name is Sarah Jacobson, I think. Qualcomm really
super rich,
Jacob Zenit, and grandfather Qualcomm. I don't know. It's just like endless amounts of money. I've watched her interviews. Doesn't really know much of what she's talking about. A few talking points, but not really somebody that you'd want to say, this is representing me. She's a person of the people. And it's just, I've heard so many people say, it's what you just said. It's impossible. She can't be beat. She has all that money behind her. We're never gonna get that seat. It's not just though that somebody great though, William, might be able to come along and talk to her constituents and say, I really do understand you. I can actually try to help your life. I can actually be your voice in Washington. It's only that. They've only said she can't be beat because she's got the money and nobody has deep enough pockets to actually give her a real race. That's sort of like where we're at a little bit. Sorry, go ahead.
No. I'm saying you hit it on the head. What money does, it takes the citizen out of the picture. She doesn't have to go campaign. She has all this money, but money can't be beaten. The problem is both parties are very elitist. So for example, they don't care where you live at. They don't care about getting the most charismatic, the most believable, meaning the constituents believe in that candidate. They don't care about getting that man or woman of the people for that district. They care about who's got the most money. G can tell you, I don't know if you're aware, but when you get into some of these bigger races, at least the San Diego Republican Party, they're like, well, you got to foot this much of for us even consider you as a possible candidate. They don't care about the fact that, oh, this guy's the best candidate, but he doesn't have a lot of money. That's our job, to help raise money for him. Instead, they want you to bring a lot of money to the table. And if you're a working class person or if you're a poor person but beloved in the community, in the district, they don't care. You know, so the Republicans don't know how to fight that battle because the Democrats really control the purse strings because of the unions and the George Soroses of the world. And it's really kind of turned our whole political system upside down. Jacobs can be beat. The problem is our system on our side is just as corrupt. And they call it, I'm sure you heard it before, they call it the consultant class. When we were off camera a month ago, we were talking about that. And I was like, you know, I was telling the person we're talking to, hey, the consultant class, it's the Republican Party hiring the consultant class. So you're saying we're losing because of the consultant class. Well, it's our own party hiring them. And what I'm trying to say is the consultant class doesn't care about getting out, talking to the people. They can care about making their own money. So they'll raise money or help you raise money. They want the candidates to raise money. They want other donors to get money. And it all goes into more technology, most of it's in technology, and they get paid up front. They don't put money into the grassroots anymore. They don't put money into walking. I've never been a big believer of phone banking the way our system's set up now, but they don't give a rat's tail about the old style politics, shaking your hand. And here's a dirty little secret. I've yet to not see this work. A candidate, when they shake the hand of the people in their district, 9 out of 10 times, they'll get that candidate's vote because that candidate, the odds of that candidate, of that constituent having shaken hands with an actual candidate. I got votes when I ran up here. More than one person told me, I go, can I count on your vote? He goes, yeah, you're the only one who came to my door and knocked. You show at least you care enough to come knock on my door. You know, so it's as simple as that. And that's just my opinion. Maybe G has a different opinion, but you're right. Money has corrupted it. Mike Levin is another one, but it's not just money. So, for example, Daryl Issa, he left the 49th district because he knew he was going to lose. He knew. And what irked me were the power players in the San Diego Republican Party would tell me to my face, no, he would have won that race. Now I'm going, well, then why did he resign? You know, and then why did he come back a couple years later in a district that he doesn't even live in? Why didn't he run back in the district he lived in? Because he knew he couldn't beat Mike Levin. And Daryl Issa is worth $400 million. So it's not always about the money. The money makes it an indomitable force, but it can be overcome. And I believe it can be overcome with charismatic candidates. Obama was the first, in my eyes, of this new generation, this new political system's way of showing us what a charismatic candidate is. Whether Trump may be 80 or in his late 70s, but he's charismatic. He's a billionaire. What billionaire do you know out there? I mean, not personally, but just on any billionaire or super rich person that is seen as the man of the people? outside of Trump. I mean, mm-hmm. so his charisma has created that persona. So these people with money can be beat, but taking Act Blue down, and this stops if you actually prosecute people with teeth. Instead, this is a third world in me coming out, where I'm like, those rich people, man, they get away with everything, you know? Because even when found guilty, oh yeah, they get 2 years house arrest, you know? I'm being sarcastic, you know? They get time. But they don't do time. I'm like, go do time with SA over there, you know? Or the brothers over there. Or the gang, the white gang. I mean, go do time with people who hate you and then come talk to me. Instead, they're all, they get their little country clubs, you know, and they still get to do business, some of them. You know, they still have their contacts, this and that. Michael Milken. I'm pretty sure, well, you should know who Michael Milken is, Annette, since you were a day doctor, right?
That meant, well, I used to work on the trading floor. Yes, I do.
That's right. Yeah. People committed suicide because he ripped them off. But because of the laws, he was able to hide 10 or 12 million through his wife after he went to prison. Then he comes out, becomes a teacher at a UCLA or a professor. I mean, he's given the red carpet treatment. And the whole time I'm thinking, you killed people indirectly. People committed suicide because you stole their money. You know, so this is where Big John would love me, because that's where the libertarian thing comes out. Like, get those rich people. I'm going to say rich whiteys, but it's not rich whiteys. It's just rich people. Because in Panama, we got a lot of rich brown people who did the same thing. You know, it's just, that's why I get angry. See, y'all got me on a rant here, and I apologize. But it's just a sore spot with me. And being a conservative, being a Republican, people get shocked because they think that only comes, that's how the liberals are supposed to think. Well, I got news for you. It's the liberals who are in bed with the billionaires now. You know, it's those, as G said, you know, his friend, you know, I got to give my mom a millionaire friends and start giving money to Kamala. Why? Because she's a puppet. Whether you like Trump or not, he's not a puppet. You know, Bush, Obama, the first Bush, the second Bush, they were all puppets. The only two I will say that weren't puppets were Reagan and Trump. And even then, they had leashes on them because they could only do so much, you know? So
I just saw a tweet. I want to say it was maybe 3 days ago or 2 days ago. 80 business leaders, billionaires, millionaires, I don't know. I think it was CEOs endorsed Kamala Harris.
Yeah.
So it goes to your point, right? It's the wealthy, right? And they know. I mean, Mark Cuban was on CNBC yesterday, and they challenged Mark on this whole capital gains taxation, right? Unrealized capital gains taxation. And Mark goes, that will never happen. They're like, but she's running on that. He's like, no, she's just saying that, but that will never happen. Because she told me it will never happen. And they're saying, but they're telling, she's telling other people, Mark, she's just telling you what you want to hear. He's like, no. And I think he said no 16 times. No. I can't even count my phone. So, yes, I think the wealthy are controlling the Democrat Party for sure.
Oh yeah, he said something on I apologize to the audience. I can't remember what he said, but somebody had a classic comeback and go, if that was a person on Shark Tank pitching you that, you tell him to get lost. And here you are trying to shove that policy that Kamala's promoting down our throats. He is Jason Whitlock. No, not Jason Whitlock. Somebody well respected said that he's bitter at the Elon Musk. He wants to be seen like Elon Musk is. He wants to be adored, but he doesn't want to take the risk that Elon Musk has taken to get where he's at. And he's bitter. He's angry. He's that hurt billionaire. Hey, Big John is back. Big John, good to have you back. He's our producer people. Yes, Big John, we saw that. You know, just to let you know. So that's a good, anyway, let me stop babbling. Let me get off my soapbox. Yeah. Let me stop with the hear me roar. Let's move on. Now, Annette, this is more in your
Okay.
It's a very serious topic. But I know you're heavy into healthcare, and I came across a story and I thought of you. The heartbeat of a nation, counting the cost of choice. And the overall increase in the abortion numbers. I've had that screen up the whole time. The overall increase in U.S. abortion numbers. 82,000 abortions per month. 82,000 per month. I mean, think about that. In 2022, 84,000, about 85,000 in 2023 per month. 99,000 per month the first 3 months of 2024. I think a lot of this has to do with what you were saying. I don't remember if we were having this conversation off camera or if we had it last week.
Yeah.
Okay. You were talking about, we just don't have a clue as conservatives and how to reach women. And a lot of this is fear. And off camera, we talked about the reproduction rates of this country going down and down. I mean, look at this. It's going up, the abortion rates. To me, this is incredibly scary. Now, women are traveling to other states, you know. So economically speaking, traveling to other states for abortion, California theoretically will be inundated. Our hospitals, our clinics, that's going to create a greater burden on taxes. So I'm asking you just from the economic standpoint, how badly will that hurt our health services here?
I mean, I really can't even imagine the impact it will have. I guess I would speak more to, just for a second, the fear. I think what's happening is people are afraid. Girls are afraid. Girls my daughter's age, maybe especially, it's going to be like The Handmaid's Tale. So they go right back into that. They don't go to somewhere that's sort of like a reasonable way to think about it. They go into, we're going to be locked up, we're going to be in some dark room just having babies for some man. I mean, they literally go into a way of thinking about it that is completely ridiculous and fear-based. I know this because 4 of my daughters are of the age where we can have these conversations. A lot of times they have their girlfriends over, we're having these types of conversations. They are Democrat only voting on this one issue. So that's why, yes, on this one issue. That's why it's so imperative that we get it right and have a real conversation about it. So when you ask me about the economics of it, I just know how poorly our healthcare system is being run right now. So I can't really imagine if people are fleeing to California for that procedure. I can't imagine. Is that an emergency room procedure? I'm not sure
clinics. I think just clinics, just doctors. I mean, for doctors here that are in the private sector, mm-hmm. it's probably mm-hmm. a lot more extra money they're going to be making from an economic sense. But to me, the real tragedy is I guess I asked you from an economic sense, but I guess you're right. This isn't even an economic issue as much as it's a it's an emotional, it's a fear, it's a human life issue.
Right, because we're not there yet. Because there are things we can talk about. There are things. So you have to understand the kids today, let's say in this demographic and in other demographics too, but the age demographic that might be having more of this. My daughters have a lot of friends who've had the experience of having an abortion. So there is prevention. Like, let's talk about that. I wish the Catholic Church, that's one thing, I'm very Catholic. I wish the Catholic Church would talk more about that. Wouldn't that be a much better way to go than to have an abortion? I think, yeah, prevention is really an important thing that would help.
Okay, question on that specifically, because mm-hmm. you are right. But here's the dilemma. What does the Catholic Church preach? Abstinence. In our society today, that's not going to happen. But the Catholic Church will not preach condoms or things like that. So you, Annette, you say you and I apologize, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I guess that's kind of what we're here for. You know, would you say to the Catholic Church to try to, so let's have that conversation. How would you approach the Catholic Church to go, we need to get this right. You're not getting it right now. And I'm not saying you have the answer, but how do you start that conversation with them?
Well, I've actually had that conversation with a lot of priests because I think it's really important to say that it would save lives. I mean, I understand that their point is that they would like to have the ideal situation where every child that is conceived is brought into a loving home with two parents who, you know what I'm saying, who made a baby, and this is the ideal situation. And I still think we can say that's a bar that we would like to have, and we would like to, a value we'd love to have as Catholics. But in reality, this is the thing. I don't think you realize, or I didn't realize, and I hate to say this for everyone who might be listening, it's a much more promiscuous world out there than I knew. So when my daughters tell me about that, I'm always like, no. And they're like, Mom, because you don't want to hear it doesn't mean it's not happening. It is happening. That is the expectation when people even have like a date on Hinge. They meet. The expectation from the man is we're going to have sex. So it's a different kind of thing. That wouldn't have been something that I would have even thought of. Do you know what I'm saying? Like on a date, but it's not seen in the same light. And as a result, I honestly think, and this makes my heart the most sad, that the abortion isn't seen in the same light. They're able to sort of like disassociate from the potential for it being a life. Now, once you've had children, that's a really hard thing to do. My friends who've had abortions.
You brought it up last week, what Clinton said, an abortion.
Yes. Rare.
We're no longer there. That's important. What was it that you told us? He said something about it should be rare or an exception, right?
Right. It should. Yes. It should be legal, but rare.
Right. Right. And we've gone away from that. Now it's legal and common.
Well, absolutely, because people don't think really much of it. They disassociate. And this is the sad thing. This is the sad thing, William. The women who want the body integrity and the body choice have literally disassociated from their own bodies. Think about what it takes to cut that potential for life or life that's beginning out of your own body and to be able to disassociate, to not think about it. So my friends that are women my age who talk now about the abortions they had in the past, when I say they're in the deep hell of regret and not denial, when they think about it now, and they've had children now, but they had the abortion before, it is like a pain so deep for them. I mean, these women, they don't talk about it, right? Because it's now would be if they were to say that, they'd say, oh, you're trying to stop me from, you know, having my choice for my body. No, just letting you know that you think you can disconnect from your body, but you really can't. Just like with sex, because I have daughters, I can say, as much as they try to disconnect from what it actually means, they don't disconnect from it. They still want the relationship. They still hope he's going to call the next day or the day after or next week. I'm sorry, but this is the truth that's happening with relationships with younger people, let's say people in their 20s. And it is a sad state of affairs. My daughters will say to me, the expectations from the boys out there, who I also think are disconnected. You know why they're disconnected? Because they're watching OnlyFans. Because they have people who
do porn. They're watching porn, yeah.
They're watching OnlyFans where someone will do whatever they want for them online. You can just, you know, I don't even want to think about it because, again, for someone like me, and my daughters always say, but you have to pay attention to what's really going on. But it's all, William, it's all connected. And it's all connected to why the abortions now are so, it's just like, it's just a procedure. It's no big deal. Not connected to that. I think later on, there is a very deep price to pay. So yes, I would, if I had Pope Francis on the phone, I'd say, priest should marry. I'd say, yes, I think. And, you know, we know that the priests, that some people, some of the apostles were married. We know that you might have shed blood for the church. Like, there's martyrs in the church. There's regular people like you and me that shed blood for the church. But I'm saying that I would say you should have an avenue to talk about contraception. It's really important.
I think we should
I
remember listening to Rush. I was working out. I always listen to Rush. I was working out. I had him on the podcast. And this lady, I think I may have told you guys this story. This lady came on. She had 30 years later, and she'd had kids. But she goes, she could not get the abortion at her. At the end of the segment, man, I'm literally in tears because you could just feel her pain. And then they make it worse. A couple of callers later, another woman. And it was I don't want to say I had an epiphany, but it made me realize what you just said. The pain that you understood immediately. That was a pain most people can't and will never, and God bless them, that we won't ever have to understand or deal with, that they have to deal with. So I think a woman has a right to make her choice. I just wish we had more mechanisms in place to have that conversation with them as to other outlets. But I get disgusted and angry when I see women with these shirts on, 24 abortions and counting. And then they probably, you know, to me, it's like, that's an abomination of what the human female body was meant to do. Meaning, sure, you had your choice, but there comes a point where, damn it, get your tubes tied, you know? It's stage your brag. And sometimes I don't even know, she's got to be lying, but who knows nowadays? Gee, you have any comments on this?
No, I mean, at church, people give their testimonies, right, of how they've changed. And they might be, you know, 40 years old, 42 years old, and they talk about the abortion that they had when they were 19 or 20 years old. And they're still, like you said, they come to tears, right? And they might have kids already that are, you know, 10, 15 years old or whatnot, but it still affects them. So I think, you know, the ones that you talk about who wear the 24 on their t-shirt, I mean, those are, they have a seared conscience. And I think most women, you know, whether they actually end up deciding to go through with it, it is life altering.
But those are the women that are front and center. This is your right. This is that. Where because they take off everything out of it. But what I'm saying, it's the few that are really creating this perception, you know? And that's what I find scary. It's sure, 24, that's outlier. But you get some of these women who are so pro-abortion without any consideration. Because I'm sorry. I think the man, the husband, should have a voice. What the downside is, how many men knock a woman up and then they disappear? You know, they give a bad name to every father who wants. He's like, oh, I'm going to be a father. I mean, what happened? I mean, there's so many dynamics.
Well, I think men do have a voice, but it's not, they don't have a legal voice, right?
So well, that's what I'm talking about.
They can say whatever they want, and then the woman will, in the end, decide and make her decision, right? Even though the man wants to keep it or whatnot. So, I mean, they have a voice. It just depends on the woman who's listening or not. But, I mean, you know, so there's this idea that, and I know some Republicans want a nationwide ban on abortion, right? So the Supreme Court decision was to say that this is a state-by-state decision. And so now they want to replace that nationwide decision that we had for, what was it, 50 years? With another nationwide decision.
Like, I know.
Let's try to be consistent, right? So I'm pro-life,
exactly.
But let's be consistent.
Exactly. No, I'm the same way. I'm like, especially with fundamentalists. I'm like, you're mad because it was they were trying to codify it, but nobody touched it because the Supreme Court pretty much had codified it. And now that you got rid of it and you're happy and you're like, yeah, states, now you want to make it a federal law. It's like, we don't want to compromise. To me, that's the true issue here. We got a question here, actually. Oh, Big John himself. Abortion is the most unsolvable political issue cutting across all ideologies. No argument here. The issue should be clear. At what point does a fetus acquire the rights all humans inherit by virtue of their humanity? Even as a libertarian, I don't have any suitable answer. And even the great philosophers offer no help on the matter. John, I'm glad you asked that question because it did, a bell did ding off. Science is at the point where they can tell that heartbeat now. And I completely forgot about that aspect. Democrats were always the ones about science, science, science. Because you didn't know when we were kids, you didn't know when that heartbeat. We didn't have the technology. Now that we do, they don't want anything to do with science. You know? So I think part of the answer can come with science. But at the same time, I am loath to take a woman's choice from her. You know? I was part of that stupid group of guys. That's all I cared about. But you know what? I grew up in the era of AIDS. Protection was always first and foremost, period, end of story. But I knew guys, oh, I don't want a condom. Well, screw that. I don't feel like a man. Whatever reason, I'm like, are you stupid? You know? Not talking about seeing just getting the girl pregnant. You don't want to be a father. You want to be a man. But it's like I can't speak for women. But most men, we don't freaking think. We think of that 40-minute pleasure. In reality, 2 minutes, but 40 minutes, we'll say. And that's all we care about, well, and that's all we think about, you know?
I was going to go back to the idea of the interstate travel, right? So I thought this would reduce the number of abortions, right? Because I kind of viewed it as a cooling off period that we have for buying weapons, right, guns. You have a three-day cooling off period to make sure that you really want to buy that gun because of that person that you really don't like across the street, right? So I thought this would be a similar thing, but so it's perplexing to me why the numbers have gone up.
Oh, I mean, look at the class. If you break it down demographically, there's a lot of working class women who look at the fact I can't afford a child. And then if the father isn't around, and the way we have, the way we talk about abortions today, this isn't shocking to me. In fact, I kind of expected it. And what I tell people is when Democrats want to sit there and uniform every state the same, I'm like, no. Each state has its own identity. If you don't like this state, go live in this state. And that's not happening. Instead, they're just going to drive on over. But that said, on the interstate, there's also something called self-managed abortions where a person, you know, they take the morning after pill. So you have those, and those numbers aren't even documented to my knowledge. Now you have the telehealth abortions. And when I was researching this, and a telehealth abortion is somebody from a state, for example, where they can't get an abortion or it's tough for them to get an abortion, they consult a doctor in a different state, and a doctor approves everything or makes sure everything's on the up and up, then sends them pills so they can kill the baby that way. So those numbers are up, which is a great question. I had not looked at it from this perspective, meaning should a doctor from a state where abortion isn't allowed or a woman in a state where abortion isn't allowed, should a doctor be sending a doctor from a state where abortion is allowed sending medication to a woman in a state that is against that, or the laws are against that, sending them medication to kill the baby. What's your stance? And I apologize if kill the baby is an improper term. I don't know what it is. That's kind of how I view it, whether right or wrong. But should that be allowed? Should a doctor from a state, an outside state, be able to send over the mail the medication needed to end a pregnancy to a woman, say, in a state where abortion is much harder to be had? Annette, I'm waiting for you, but gee, let's get the man's answer first before we get Annette's answer on this.
Well, I mean, I believe in the ruling that the Supreme Court made. So if a state decides you can't do that, then the state decides you can't do that. So I think some of these loopholes will be corrected. Then again, there's the enforcement of it, right? So you can say, Texas, you can't send drugs over the border, but then they get the brown package with no label. Yeah. So how are you going to know, right? So there's the enforcement of it. So you can say that, but then you got to enforce it. So I think leave it to the state. They can decide what to do and let the people vote on it, vote the representatives to make the laws. Regarding these ideas here in California, we all know it will be allowed.
Yeah, right. And then we'll close this segment out with your thoughts on this and anything else you want to add to it.
Well, I think that John made a really good point. I just wanted to say that because then it was up a few minutes ago and it about even the great philosophers. Cause I've read, you put it back. Okay. Yeah. A lot of people have written about this issue. A lot of people in bioethics have written about this issue. Conception, the heartbeat, when the fetus would be viable outside the womb. Is that the date? So is that, I think that is now, it's earlier and earlier with medical care. So it's like maybe 4 months. So there is great debate and conversation about that with no good answers. And I think the interesting thing about our society is, I want what I want when I want it, and I want it. So if it's a designer baby or a surrogate having a baby, or me going out and buying eggs and implanting them in someone else, or me going out and buying sperm and then using that for myself because I don't want to have a partner, but I want to have a baby. I mean, what are we doing? Why isn't anyone talking about that? That is also a piece of this. It's like both ends of the spectrum. So I want to have a baby, but if it's not right, I'm just going to like get rid of it if the timing's bad or the relationship doesn't work out. But then there's people that are alone getting babies in all kinds of ways and designing the babies exactly the way they want them and things that I didn't even realize were happening in terms of picking and choosing qualities. There's a lot more that they can do now, and that end of things as well, that is a bioethics issue. Is that stuff okay to be ethically is what we're doing okay. So I don't, the science is way ahead of the ethics. We're not having good conversations about it. I'm having those conversations at home with my daughters because I say that you have a responsibility. So if people want to talk about their bodies, what about a responsibility to your body? And by the way, I had three miscarriages. It's not an abortion, but it was terminated very hard in my body, each and every one of those. So I can only imagine that there is some implications and health implications of having abortions. It's not a nothing procedure. You know, those parts of your body are extremely delicate and I don't want to say fragile. You know, they're actually durable, but they're delicate. And so I think we're not really talking about the fact that there are health implications to having multiple abortions. Not a great thing to do when you finally want to have that child. You know, you have to have a uterus that is sturdy and a cervix that can hold it up. So I don't think, I think we're barely talking about it. We're talking about it in the most rudimentary and ignorant ways right now. My body, my choice. What does that even mean? Like, let's really talk about it then. And that's where maybe women need to pick up that conversation and have it in a more realistic way.
And sorry, I do have go ahead, G.
Another,
go ahead.
And I know we want to move on to the next topic, but this is important,
this
I think.
Is so good,
I think it was Emperor Vespasian. Might be wrong on the emperor, but during the Roman Empire, they didn't have abortions back then, right? Or they might have, but the way they normally did is they had the baby to term, the baby's born, and they decide, nope, not that one. So they would take the baby to the river. And just leave it, they wouldn't kill the baby, they just leave it out there to die, right? So during that time, that was their version of it, right? And it was just accepted normal behavior. So when you're talking about the ethics, like, can the United States ever reach that point? Absolutely, because the Roman Empire did. And this was hundreds of years after their founding. And an interesting thing is that Christians, during the time, they would go to the river and they would find these babies. And they would adopt them as their own, which is an interesting side note. So I just thought that fit really nicely into what you're saying about the ethics, because we can go to a point where a baby's born and we go, nope, not that one.
Yeah, right.
Can I just say one last thing now?
I'm adopted. Take your time.
I'm adopted, and I think that's why I'm passionate about this, because it was before Roe versus Wade, I think. No, maybe I wasn't, but I know my mom was on the crux about giving me up, and her mom made her go to a place and have me and then give me up for adoption. But it was all documented that they wished that my biological mother, wished that wouldn't have been the case. And then I went off to Catholic Charities, and thank goodness the nuns, you know, kept me until someone adopted me. But
that's a great point. People in the movies, they always portray it as a very negative, an embarrassment to the family when they would send the daughter away because she got pregnant. The silver lining is they would have the baby and it'd be put up for adoption. You know, I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but if the baby's viable, it can be born, it can make another family happy. But again, it's the woman's choice. I didn't realize that we had this conversation. There's two topics that I get passionate and I get angry about, and it's abortion and war, because they are extremes and we have turned them into these easy decisions. I get so angry. I got so mad and I feel bad. Poor Big John takes the brunt of my anger at times. I just get so mad because in war, I'm like, yeah, you want to kill your enemy, kill them all. But war is an absolute last resort. Because people die. You don't want to go to war. You do everything to prevent war. But when you go to war, you do everything to minimize the casualties on your side, period, end of story. Wars get prolonged when politicians start talking peace this, peace that. Because history has shown war ends when one side wins. When you get this compromise, all it does is give one side the opportunity to rebuild and go at it again. And the Middle East is big for that. And I view abortion the same way. It's an extreme. And I didn't realize that we were talking about it. I get so angry because it's devastating. Both of them are devastating. There's no winner at the end. Sure, somebody, she had the abortion. The mother got rid of the kid like she wanted. You win a war at the cost of so many deaths. It's like, I know libertarians, for example, have a big issue with the nuclear bombs dropping. And I get it. And I get it, especially how Truman got some of the information. But I also know this. We saved potentially a couple of million American lives in not prolonging the war for another 2 to 3 years. Not to mention, history does not teach about the invasion of Okinawa that was avoided, that they were surmising was going to cost tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of American deaths. You don't invade a country like Japan on their home turf and not expect heavy casualties. So I think of all that, and it's all ugly. I think of the bombing of Berlin and all those innocent people, you know, who were bombed. And I'm like, these are evil necessities. That's why you don't go to freaking war if you can avoid it. That's why I have went from a patriotic guy during the invasion of Iraq to a few months later going, what the hell are we doing in there? We're just sending our guys. And then it killed me when it was the Democrats, but in another cycle, it could have been the Republicans when they voted no for the funding to protect the Humvees from the IEDs that would blow up. Because they were playing politics. And ever since that whole incident, I just changed my mind. I'm like a 60s hippie, you know, no more war, because we don't go to war. It's these military industrial complex. I know that gets away from abortion, but my point is these are two extremes that we as people no longer look at it in the serious capacity we need to look at it. And that's abortion and war. Cause at the end of the day, they both mean death. And honestly, deep down, I think all of us just want to put our hands together, and we do want to sing Kumbaya, you know, but we know that's a silly, trite trope that everybody says. But deep down, I don't think anybody would be against it if there was a way to make it possible to find a happy medium with the woman. Well, I mean, to me, the happy medium is for a guy, we're a damn condom, you know, for the woman, you know, I don't know. And the woman, and I know I said, let's move on. But Annette, even as a woman, it's like my wife was educating me on all the issues with birth control pills, what they do to the body, how they can cause you to not be able to have babies on the road, things. I never knew any of that. To me, that's a magic pill for women. Hey, you're on the pill. No big deal. But it is a big deal. So you're right. We had no understanding, we as men, and then women as we said, down years later, the mental anguish. And I would not be shocked if women have committed suicide after abortions, just the trauma. I mean, I'm not saying they have, but I would not be shocked to find numbers on that, you know. But anyway, I'm sorry I got on my soapbox again. Annette, we'll give you the last word here and we'll move on.
Well, I would just say legal but rare. I mean, that's really where I stand on it. I hope the Catholic Church moves the dial and has a better conversation. I hope that we as women support our daughters and love them into trying to love life and respect their bodies and have relationships that are fruitful. And I'm just saying that can be a piece of it, right? But loving your body and having choice, respecting your body isn't only just the right to abortion, but they end it right there. They act like that's the only conversation worth having when it's actually a much bigger picture and a much deeper picture. And I think that's the conversation that I have with my daughters. And I think that this topic could go on for me for several hours, but maybe not with you two guys, but I do get fired up about it.
There you go. And with that, let's be very brief because we have to talk about the preview of the debate, but real quick, just a couple of comments here. Kamala Harris buying influencers. And the influencers, this happened a few weeks ago, but there are about two or three prominent influencers. One of them had like 30 million followers across the platform, and they just all went off on her like this, like they kept, because she wouldn't take no. In essence, she was trying to buy them to give at least, at the very least, the perception that, hey, we're endorsing Kamala here. So what do you think in this new world of politicians? And I'm sure Republicans are going to try this if they haven't already. You know, they try to get these influencers to buy them. What are your thoughts on that, G?
I mean, I don't know that it's right or wrong. It's certainly not genuine. So, you know, you get this influencer to say something about you because you gave them money. I mean, that's what these Democrat operatives that show up on CNN are. I mean, they're just CNN has a lower viewership than TikTok at this point. So, yeah, is it wrong? No, because a lot of these influencers who are, like, true to themselves are saying no, right? With, you know, kudos to them. I do appreciate that Donald Trump's not doing that. So I watch a lot of YouTube videos of, I think OK Rick is one of them. Cartier Family is another one. You know, Reckless. Okay, so these are all black guys, and they're pro Donald Trump, and they're just hilarious. I just love watching them. I know they're not getting a dollar from Donald Trump, right? But it's just coming out of their heart. It's genuine. So yeah, there are a lot of influencers out there that are getting paid, and I don't know that it would really make a difference. I mean, so I remember, I think it was the first show, Craig and I were on it, and we were talking about Donald Trump needs to up his social media game because Kamala's killing it. But I think at the time there was also like a little bit of doomerism going around on the right hand side of the aisle. So I did see Donald Trump's TikTok page, and I'm looking at it right now. 10.8 million followers with 43 million likes.
And that's Kamala organic. Harris,
5 million followers, so less than half with 37 million likes. And I mean, if you scroll down, there's, what is that, 40 videos, and Donald Trump has maybe 15. So, you know, will it make a difference? It does make a difference, but I think people doing it from a genuine heart, I think that's more effective.
Right. No, I agree. I agree with you, G. What's the difference between a TikTok influencer and the 50 bottom paid for ex-CIA intelligence officers that signed a letter that was an obvious lie? They were doing that to try to influence. You know, your thoughts, TikTok or these media ads or whatever, aren't they all kind of the same? They're trying to influence, and it's not always honorable. It's just an ideological belief, meaning they may hate Kamala, but I'm a Democrat. I got to support her. Whereas Trump is, whether you like him or not, Trump comes across as genuine. Whether he is or not doesn't matter. And then, like G was saying, you have those group of black men that are rising up to support him, because in their mind, they're like, we see what's happening here. You know, and the Democrats got really pissed when he got arrested, and a lot of black men came out, I can relate to him. And the first thing the Democrats, you racist. But my take was, well, actually, they can relate to him now in some sense, because statistically, the stats show that. But going back to the influencers, your take on that, Annette?
Well, I hate to break it to Kamala, but a lot of these influencers are being watched by, again, those young girls in those demographics. And they want to see a girl in a beautiful hotel in Rome in some sort of fancy outfit. They could care less about politics. No, they're seriously bored by it. They don't give it any credibility. And I want to tell you, I hate to break it to her again, they see right through it. So they're literally interested in the yacht picture with the new striped outfit and where they got it and how cool the luxury lifestyle is looking like. That's what they want to see on their TikTok. That's what they want the influencers to show them, what they're wearing, where they're at, the latest place they want to vacation. I don't think it's really that meaningful, and unfortunately, and it doesn't really gonna, I don't think they're taking it seriously, like, oh, yeah, she's got that influencer. No.
I think you're right. I think you're right from that perspective. Again, what makes Trump different, and I say Trump, I don't say Republicans, but I say what makes Trump different is his is natural. That one interview that went, that once it went across and spread and went viral, like 100 million people saw it. I mean, his son facilitated that interview because the guy liked Trump, the influencer. So Trump's getting influencers who actually like him, and that will make a difference. And you're right. In today's day and age, it's much harder to pull the wool than before we entered this technological era. Okay, so G, and then Annette, any final words on this before we move on to the big topic?
No, I think gimmicks don't work, right? So you look back to the day after the final day of the DNC, and the headline was Kamala had, I forgot the number, 22 million, which was 20% more than Trump, right?
Right, it was like a couple million more, yes.
But they knew that they needed to get more people to watch, so they made this, we might have Taylor Swift, or we might have whoever it was, or we might have George W. Bush showing up to the DNC tonight. So everyone tunes in to see what's going on. And then all of a sudden, nope, all they got is Kamala, right? So those gimmicks, like, okay, you'll get the numbers so you can have that headline tomorrow. But I think in the end, that these kind of gimmicks, paying TikTok influencers, it just pisses people off.
And going back to the money conversation, that's exactly what people thought when they say she raised like $100 million like in 2 or 3 days. We're like, what? No freaking way. You don't go from the most disliked and least liked person to we're shattering a record like that. That's not organic. So you're right. People can't see through that. All right. Let's get to the final topic, and I apologize for the length, people. Who thought that abortion, you know, abortion is one of the heaviest topics you can think about. And I was an idiot to think, oh, we're going to talk 10 minutes on it. You know?
That was supposed to be a quick hit, right?
Exactly. A quick hit.
Sorry.
No, that was not your fault. That's on me as the host. And that's on me. That should have been one of the heavy topics unto itself. So I screwed that up, and my apologies to the audience, but it was a great discussion, I thought. So the Great American Showdown. Trump versus Harris, the art of the deal meets the politician with benefits. And for the audience who doesn't know that, yeah, I'm not a Kamala fan, but I know her history. And G knows her history. I'm not sure if you do in that, but when you got involved in politics and you started learning about the Democrat Party, and then I started learning first about Kamala, I'm like, that's a good-looking woman. She's attorney general or whatever. And then somebody's like, let me tell you a story. And that's what I learned about. And that's what they said. Let me tell you the story about Kamala. And that they filled me in about Willie Brown, her personality, how she moved up, and she was like a dirty little secret. And nobody has ever thought she would get to the point where she's at, but she is ruthless too. But anyway, we're at the debate here. The debate is September 10th, this coming Tuesday, 9 p.m., ABC News, and David Muir and Lindsay Davis are the moderators, which I think is great. My big fear was George Stephanopoulos being a moderator. Him and Candy Crowley are like two peas in a pod. Now, Trump enters this debate, obviously, with concern about potential moderator bias. There's no way you can't deny that. This goes all the way back to 2012. I don't know if you two remember the presidential debate where moderator Candy Crowley purposely and incorrectly intervened to support and protect Obama, who was floundering at a question when it came to Benghazi. And she pretty much told Mitt Romney that, but you're wrong. Senator Romney or whatever his title was, or Governor Romney. And it turns out she was wrong. And she purposely lied to help Obama. And it's been a train wreck since then in terms of debates for Republicans. The media is leftist. The data shows that when you got 95% pro-Obama media stories, 90% negative Trump stories, that alone tells you. So Trump has legit issues. So given this history, we don't know what to expect. The doomsday, nobody, now I couldn't find much predictions on the conservative side, but the Democrats, like I pulled two of them. Michael Moore, who everybody knows from Fahrenheit 9/11 or 9/11, voting for Columbine, and Representative Jasmine Crockett. They pretty much say Trump's just an immature idiot. And Kamala's going to clean up. The general outlook is Democrats are optimistic that Kamala's going to be able to pull this off and destroy Trump. And they expect her to leverage, was the term I found, leverage her prosecutorial skills effectively, whereas Trump's just unconventional. As conservatives, what's your perspective? And we'll start with you, Annette. What's your perspective and your general outlook going into this debate for Trump?
I have a lot of thoughts about this. And I just want to mention Michael Moore, who did Roger and Me about Flint, Michigan.
Yes,
did
Roger.
You ever see that? That was actually, I thought that was a good documentary. Okay. About what was happening to the workers, the union workers in Flint, Michigan. It was actually really interesting.
Hold on. What was it about real quick for the audience?
Oh, Roger and Me was about the workers in Flint, Michigan, when the layoffs happened, and they were the car industry. And he was trying to find basically Roger, who was the CEO of, I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the actual car industry at the time, which was it Chevy? I mean, one of those big ones, right? One of the big cars industries. And basically the whole that whole town was decimated by what happened with the layoffs there. And he showed the homes, the homelessness, those people that worked in the factory, their lives just being uprooted and many times being destroyed. It's actually it was a very compelling look at that. And I don't know. I guess I was moved by it. Yeah, GM.
Right. Okay, yeah. GM. And poor Flint. Really Flint, they went from that to the water. It's like, you know, they can't win for lose. So what's your outlook?
So my outlook for this is, if Trump does, you brought up Willie Brown. Everyone knows that story. Everyone knows about how Kamala is ruthless. I think he needs to stay away from that. I think Trump can prevail on that you actually have been there in the White House. These problems that you're going to attend to, you could have been attending to them. So what is your record? And if you're going to say anything about Biden, obviously she was part of the big cover-up. She had to know about his decline. She pretends that he was great and I guess is still doing great now. But he needs to be out because she needs to take over because he's not doing great. I don't know how she gets around that. If he sticks to that, you've been there to fix the problems that you haven't been able to fix. If you're going to get on the border, why didn't you? If you're going to be taken care of, you know, all of the things that have not been attended to in terms of the Biden White House for the last 4 years, how is she going to be able to cover up that bad record? I don't know how she's going to do it. And how is she going to be able to say that this person who has been really absent and in decline for a very long time and completely unable to be effective in their job because they're not cognitively there, that cover up, I mean, if he doesn't go and a personal attack and talks just about her being weak, I think he's going to be absolutely fine, and I think he can actually pull it off. I just think he just can't get too personal, because the personal attacks, she's going to be able to make something from those. If it talks about, like, she wasn't – that's how she made her rise to the top. People can also criticize him in certain ways that have to do with, like, his personal life. Do you know what I mean? I think he needs
right,
to say
– Well, she's a woman. He needs a woman vote. He doesn't have the suburban vote. He shouldn't alienate it any further, I think, is what you're trying to say.
That's what I'm trying to say. I'm sorry if I'm not saying it well, but I think that will be a mistake if he goes there.
I agree. It's I feel Trump's pain. It's like being a kid in a candy store. It's just easy pickings, but you're right. Yeah. Politically speaking, he has so much in the war chest he can use. He doesn't need to go there. Gee, your general take.
Yeah, when I look back at the last Biden-Trump debate, I noticed Trump had a different tactic than he did back 4 years ago, and he was more calm, he was more measured. And I say more because it wasn't completely measured, and it wasn't completely calm, but he was more of that. And I think if he comes in and he says, okay, my main goal here is, one, talk about the economy, how bad it is. We're going into recession, and it's Kamala who did it, right? And point right back to her and say, it's your administration that's put us in this mess. You printed money. Now you have inflation. You know, carne asada burrito costs $15 now. I mean, what insane prices, right? So if he sticks to, one, that theme, two, how the world has become more dangerous, and I know Tulsi Gabbard has been helping him with the debate prep, and she's going out there saying, we've never been closer to nuclear war than today, right? Mm-hmm. So if he can hammer that and say, we'll pull out of these wars, we will pull out of Ukraine, we will settle that thing quickly, and we'll make the world safe again, right? That will be the second thing. I think the third thing is to, and he needs to get personal with Kamala only in the sense of she's phony, fake, and a liar, right? So she's prevented the decline, like Annette said, or prevented or hid the decline of Joe Biden, like Annette had referred to. But also, like, you know, she's not a real person, and I think people know that. She's flip-flopped on these issues, and she's taken the border wall. I predicted it. Show number two or three, I said she's going to take the border wall and
oh,
making her
right,
own.
You did. And, when you said that, I was like, I don't know.
She did. It's in one of her campaign commercials. And the only thing left for my prediction is she's going to say Mexico's going to pay for it. So that's not going to come true. I'll accept defeat on that prediction. But all the others were there. So he just needs to say, look, you're taking all my positions. I mean, all she has to do is wear an orange wig, and there she is, Donald Trump, right? just an,
right.
an authentic well, version of it.
So she's going to try to provoke Trump. Let's talk very briefly about this. I believe she wanted the mics on. See, to me, the mic being off was like Trump's team, Biden's. See, Biden should not have agreed to that, but or had demanded it because it helped Trump. I think Trump's team, you can't control Trump. And I think with the mics off, Trump's team were like, yeah, because, you know, Trump can't help himself. So I think that's why Kamala wanted the mics on. I don't care. It had anything to do with what she wanted. She knew he would lose it. And because he was a terrible debater in 2020. He kept interrupting. It was just terrible. He looked bad, you know. Yeah. So I think that's why she wanted the mic. Your thoughts, Annette, on why she wanted the mics on.
Oh, that's totally why. To bait him, for sure. And she knows that. I agree with G, though. His last debate with Biden, he was more measured.
Oh, and because of that. The mics were off.
Oh, you thought, do you think that's why?
Oh, he couldn't respond back. You know, the only time he kind of lost it, it worked out perfectly. Mm-hmm. He had this goofy look like, I don't know what he said. Well, you know, nobody knows what he said. That was as close as he got to losing it, and it worked perfectly. Because after he spoke, I was thinking, I kind of get what Biden said. And then when he said that, I was like, oh, yeah, that was the best answer he could give. But I think it would have gone south had that mic been on. He just would have lost it. Trump would have – let me put it this way. His – closing speech at the RNC convention was about coming together, about he was going to sit there, you know, I almost got killed. It showed me the light. This is what we needed to do. That lasted for all of 30 seconds before he went back into rally mode and gave a 45 or hour and a half speech because the mic was on. And I'm a big Trump supporter, but I knew him as a great debater. The people are like, oh, William, you saw him in the Republican primaries 2016. Yeah, with 15 other people where it was a soundbite debate for the first two-thirds debate. When he debated Rubio and Cruz, they made him look like an idiot. And then it was so bad that he chose not to debate Cruz the final time, you know? And what saved him with Hillary is Hillary was just a worse debater than he was. You know, I mean, she had so many skills. And Trump was brilliant. I think he rattled the Clintons when he brought all these women and sat him right up front on stage. I think that rattled him. So I think Trump has been so lucky. The Biden debate was another lucky one. But I could be wrong. But that said, I'm glad the mics are off because I think it helps him. He can't be baited.
He can't control himself.
I will say 2020, the tactic Trump came in with is to throw so much at Biden that in his advanced age that he'd get confused and just look impotent, right? That was the tactic. But Biden actually came off looking pretty strong. So it backfired, and then the next two debates, Trump was on the defensive pretty much. So when I look back to the Hillary debates, Trump was a lot more measured. I mean, absolutely was. So it seemed like I think he will be that way this time. And you know, he might have a nice quips or comebacks. I mean, he could use the line like, "I don't think she knows what she just said," and I don't.
I
know what I just. I don't know what she just said, but I don't think she knows either, or something, right? Because of her word salad. So, I think that's going. People are going to look at that and just. I mean, they're going to be looking for that word salad, right. And without her notes, which is another minus for her.
Exactly.
I think she's prepping so hard for the debate right now that she's going to start saying things like deadlines of time, which, okay, what other kind of deadlines are there except ones of time? So, yeah.
Part of her problem per her own staff, because she's had a high turnover, they're saying she doesn't ever want to learn anything. She doesn't want to learn the issues. And the problem with politicians is they don't learn the issues. They memorize enough to get it through an interview. So you can memorize everything, but when you start having to actually give a coherent statement on what you believe and it's memorized and you tumble up, the word salad. Now, real quick, the other reason Trump did well against Hillary is because he was measured. Because and I don't want to use the word, but the bleep in the Billy Bush interview was made public that day. So that's another reason he was – a bit demure about that. So that actually helped his personality from going crazy. So I think the stars have aligned for him. Question here. One of the tactics Harris is going to use, or that her team has said, is that where'd it go? They're gonna focus on Trump's inaccuracies and lies in real time to fact check him. And I'm like, the lies I see are coming from her side on the economy, on inflation, on the board. So I mean, it's like I just look at that campaign. I'm like, what are you guys talking about? If you were a Democrat in her campaign, Annette, what would be your focus in tackling this debate from her perspective and how to attack Trump?
Oh, that's a really great question.
That's why I'm the host.
That's a really great question. If I was trying to, what would be the thing that I would I really think that she would lose if she was going after his policies, because he has strong policies and he's been really good for productivity and America, and he's been really good with our foreign policy. He's got really strong points there. I mean, I guess the only thing I can think of would be trying to get him unhinged, honestly, trying to rile him up, trying to get him unhinged, trying to get him so he says something that – is like, you know how he can be crass and he can be a little bit rude sometimes. That part of his personality.
Are you saying then to play the girl role? Oh, he's attacking me. I look so bad. And society says, how dare you attack her like that? I mean, that's what I'm hearing. I'm not saying it's wrong, but that's the only tactic I kind of see her.
That's the only thing that I can think of that I think might be able to serve something up for her if she goes down that role, because, you know, he can get triggered sometimes, and then she can play the, like, right? Like, oh, you know, he's attacking me. And
as
you know,
a man, I hate that, but it works.
I do too.
Instinct is to protect a woman. So when we see something like that, we're like, whoa, what are you doing, dude? Come on. You know, it doesn't matter that she could be Xena, the warrior, and beating the hell out of you. You know,
or Medusa.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So, to flip it around, if you were in Trump's camp, what would you focus on in defeating, in getting Kamala off her game? What would be your tack to go, President Trump, this is what we need to focus on, what we need to do for you to dominate this debate?
Yeah, I think the main one, focus on the issues, right? But then the other one is the phoniness and the lying, right? And the flip-flopping. So he could go after her and say, look, you said you're going to confiscate guns, and even Biden during the debate said we got to be constitutional. And remember, she goes, well, Biden, instead of saying no, we can't, we should say yes, we can. Ha ha ha! And then she laughed, right? So use those sound bites, right, and say. And she did it in the debate, and she said we can confiscate guns via executive order. So attack that and then put it on the defensive. Oh, so now you're saying no. You said you're going to ban fracking, but now you're saying no, right? And then if, and I don't know if anyone else is realizing this, I'm realizing it, but when she has to explain her core beliefs, she does it with eye contact and conviction. She's still word salad, but at least she does it with eye contact and conviction. But when play this moderate part, then she starts looking down.
Well, no, it's not that. It's her beliefs are pure socialist leftists. Like when she was bad-mouthing Elon. Oh, no, he lost his she didn't say the First Amendment is a right. She said it was a privilege. She forgets the reality of what America is, our values and our laws, and she falls into her socialist belief. So you're right, G. That is, she's good when she gets in that mode, but she screws it up because everybody goes, whoa, is that Fidel Castro talking? Or Manuel Noriega?
But that's the thing, like she's confident, right? So she's looking at Jake Tapper saying he lost his privilege to say whatever he wants, and we need to have speech with oversight. And those are the terms that she used, right? But she said it with conviction. She said it with eye contact. She said it with confidence. But then you look at the CNN debate or CNN interview last week or the week before, and she was demure. She was insecure. She was looking down a lot because she's not speaking from her heart anymore. She's speaking from this part of the brain that she has to think through, and it's clicking, right? And she's like, wait a minute, how am I supposed to word this? Okay, this is how I'm supposed to word it, because I don't believe in fracking, but now I need to talk as if I do believe in fracking. And now I need to talk as if I do believe in the Second Amendment. And so that's where Trump can throw her off her game by having her on these flip-flop positions. And hopefully she goes right back to where she has the conviction, and people can see in her eyes and say,
right,
no, you can't say whatever you want in this country, and I'm going to change that on day one. And then everyone goes, whoa, that's
exactly
not what I want, right? So
exactly.
That's, if I were advising Trump, that's what I would tell him to do.
That's a great point. That's what I agree with that too, because it's like, my issue is when I said the memorization, you know, that they memorize, that's the problem they run into. When they memorize and they get a little, the moment you memorize and it just takes a quick instant and you lose your thought and you don't know because you don't believe what you're saying. So you forget where, it's like a lie. You kind of forget where you're at. But then when she goes to her conviction, she gives herself away and who she really is. Annette. Now, we're all at fault here. We're all at fault here. We just had a long topic on abortion. One of the very few strengths she has that I would tell her to bring up is reproductive rights. You know, because that's a party issue that's broken up. And, you know, good and well, that ABC moderator, there's going to be a reproductive question. How I'm putting you in Trump's shoes, because we know how she's going to come through it. She's going to say women's rights, Republicans, they want to kill, but you know, or not kill, but they, you know, they want to take away your rights. You're in Trump's camp now. What would you go, President Trump, this is how you need to handle the comeback question when they ask you about reproductive rights and where you stand? What would you tell them?
I would make a point that the Supreme Court did the right thing by putting it in the hands of the states. I think that that was something, a really great, they did a really great job with that. I think it's hard because I have a question, William, because I would say legal but rare. I mean, I don't see how Trump does he lose his pro-lifers if he makes a compromise here? I think it's so dangerous to be absolute about this issue. I do. I think it's dangerous.
It's wrong. It's wrong. Because it is not an absolute issue. Yeah. But no politician wants to be honest enough. I'm sorry. I keep interrupting. Go ahead.
No. It's okay. I'm just saying this is because I understand that he's got the Bible Belt, you know, and I understand there are some people that this is there on the other side. They're one issue too. They want from conception, you know, to birth. They believe that womb should be protected just like that person's already outside the womb. And that's why I think that, and they get fired up. They want somebody who's going to say that that's where they stand. And I think that for the President of the United States, and the world we live in today, we have to be in reality, and he has to be able to be a little more balanced than that, or you're going to evoke all kinds of fear on the other side, and you're going to lose people who otherwise would definitely be in his camp if he can just say that it should be legal but rare. That's really all he needs to say, that he doesn't want to bring us back to some sort of state where women, again, are like, you know, barefoot and pregnant, at their husband's command, having children, you know what I'm saying? Like in some dark room, you know, that they have an image that might not be real, but that women are very afraid about this. Young girls are afraid about it.
I know what you're saying. I had a fired up podcast with the women of San Diego from Lexington. It's a very fundamentalist bound group, and they were upset.
Yeah.
Because Trump doesn't want to codify and make abortion illegal. So they're saying they're going to take their bottle and go home. Big John was just pinging me as well and saying that they're already starting to abandon. I don't think they will. I don't think they will. But if I was in Trump's camp, I would say, Mr. President, you need to, it's not an absolute. You need to be man enough and admit it. This is a battle. We took it out of government's hand at the federal level because it's a state's issue. Now you have to go battle this issue over there. I will support you as best as I can, but this is a state's issue. You know, mm-hmm. if California, where Ms. Harris is from, wants to have the abortion and that's what the people want, that is their right at stake. Our right as pro-lifers is to combat and have that daily battle to help convince people. I think he's got to humanize it. I think that's the only way. Because when I was in that, because I was getting angry at these fundamentalists, and I like them. I love them to death. But I was getting angry. I'm like, you're upset because he gets rid of Roe versus Wade, but you're upset that that's not enough. I go, it's never enough. I go, and I threw it back in their face. I go, okay, take your bottle and go home. All you're doing is destroying your daughter's lives and their daughter's lives because you're giving up the fight today. They didn't like hearing that. Now, I wouldn't tell President Trump to say that, but I would tell them to kind of say it as I did. I think the problem with the Republicans is we don't want to humanize this. We want to give an absolute answer. There is no absolute answer. This is a state-by-state battle. And I also brought up to those fundamentalists, I said, look at the Ohio bill. It went down in flames. I go, even pro-life women don't want their choice taken away.
That's true.
I go, and you don't seem to understand that. You know, see, so, and I've had this conversation with Big John a lot. It's like, I love him, but I pull my hair out. It's because you don't understand. You cannot become Puritan, like a Puritan, you know, all the negative connotations of, you know, the Puritanical regime back in the Salem era. But, you know, it's like I said last week, you know, you're a witch. Well, if you sink, you're not a witch. If you float, you're a witch and we're going to kill you. It's like it's a lose-lose. And that's what Trump has to avoid. And I think what I said helps avoid that because she's going to be like a, what's it saying, like a pit bull on a
dog with a bone?
Yeah, exactly. There you go, dog with bone. And it's like if you're an odds maker, you put all the odds on Kamala winning this round. So Trump has to go in there and minimize the damage done. And I think humanizing it and becoming honest about it and, more importantly, stating I took the federal government out of this like the people wanted. The downside is Trump says, well, you know, everybody wanted it gone. And that's not true. Half the country wanted Roe versus Wade to stay. You know, Trump, he can't be even cute. He always goes to the extreme. You know, it's like he always says, oh, it's the greatest whatever. You know, that's his downfall. But that's how I would do it. That's where I think Kamala's, I think they're going to go there quick and early, and they're going to try to make that a focal point. Now, Trump's approaching this very informally, G, meaning he views his rallies and his talks and all his interviews as great training. I think he's right. I think they're getting the right approach. He's got Tulsi in there. That's very important because I don't care what anybody says. Tulsi Gabbard ended Kamala's presidential run in that debate.
Yep.
He's got other people to help him. But I think these debates, these interviews, why? Because they've all been in unfriendly places. CNN, MSNBC, right. He's gone 16. He's gone to all the unfriendly. So I think he's prepared really well. But I still think that he needs some kind of formal training. I think Kamala is, it's kind of like she's like a college student who's waited to the last night to study for the finals. So I think the approach that Trump's taking is great. I think Kamala's approach can hurt her. G, what are your thoughts? And then Annette, we'll go to you, to yours before we end up our final questions.
Well, I'm gonna answer that with a suspicion that I have. So when Biden was running, we had Governor Newsom all over the country. Governor Newsom's nowhere to be seen right now.
Yeah.
Right? You haven't heard from him. Mm-hmm. I mean, since right after Biden's debate. So he did show up in this podcast, and the host asked him, what do you think about the primary process? And Governor Newsom made some jokes about, oh, it was a very open, bottom-up, we the people type of process. And I've been told to say that. That's what he said, right? So.
Oh, wow.
If I'm him, and so it's probably surprising to you guys hearing that. But
I mean, if you're Newsom, is what you're saying.
Newsom said this. Okay. Newsom said this. He said it as a joke, but then he said, I was told to say this, right? That this was an open process and we all support Kamala, right? So if I'm Newsom, if Kamala wins, I don't have a shot till 20, or for 8 years. So what is that? 2032, right? But then if you have 12 years of Democrat rule, it's probably going to be Republican winning in 2032, right?
Right.
So But if she loses, the party just gets torn apart right now, right? Just with Biden and Kamala, and then who can ride in to save the party, right? Could be Gavin Newsom. So I almost feel like there's no one, it feels like there's no one in there telling Kamala, do more of this, do more of that, meet with the media. They're actually giving her bad advice. That's what it seems like.
Okay, gotcha, gotcha.
Right? So, yeah. I'm sorry, this is a long-winded way of saying it, but that feels like they're either giving her no advice or she's just getting bad advice, meaning the ones who have the experience, like the Obamas, like the Hillary Clinton, like the Governor Newsoms, right? He's really good as a politician. They're not in there advising her. So it feels like she's on her own doing this, and she's making missteps along the way, like, oh, yeah, let's support the border wall. I mean, there's no way Obama said, hey, oh, yeah, you know, support the border wall, unless they're intentionally giving her bad advice. So what I think is happening is no one's prepping her for this debate. I mean, she's probably getting prepped by her little group and then the Biden group, which I saw in Axios, I think it was the Axios or New York or Atlanta article about Atlantic article about how the two camps of the Biden people jumping in with the Kamala people are at war with each other, right? And then there's a couple Obama people in there trying to help out, and it's just a big mess. I don't think she's getting prepped very well, and if she is, it's probably memorizing, like we talked about earlier.
Well, I know what you're saying. I think what you're saying is the fact that when they pushed Biden out, they were hoping for a Democrat convention to select a nominee. This is where Kamala's ruthlessness stepped in. She took the bull by the horn because logic dictates the VP would be the one who would ascend. They didn't want that. That's why Newsom was going everywhere, because they all saw the writing on the wall. The debate was done early for the purpose of, if Biden does well, all right, man, we're going to sit there and keep moving forward. But if he flounders, we're going to push him out. He floundered, they pushed him out. They were counting on the convention. Newsom was one of the candidates for the convention. Kamala took the bull by the horns and just, it's mine. And nobody challenged her.
Remember, Biden announced and 15 minutes later endorsed Kamala.
That's right. And that was
a... Didn't Obama hold out for a while and Nancy Pelosi held out for a while?
Held out because they wanted it to go to the convention. But just like Biden did with the gay issue against Obama's will back when Obama was president, forced Obama to a corner, that was his goal when he endorsed her. Well, it's a president. Whether you like him or not, he's still the president. And they ran with it. And they're now looking at Kamala. If she wins, we have control for 4 to 8 years and she'll do as she's told. But if she loses, we're done with a terrible candidate forever. You know, that's how they're looking at her. So to your point, G, she's probably not getting much support from within that infrastructure, but she's got a lot of money. She can hire a lot of professional help. So Annette, do you think Trump's preparation of being informal, using the rallies and interviews as his base, and then having Tulsi and a few others there to coach him, right approach? And do you think Kamala is cramming too much? And in reference to G's point, she's not getting good advice. Your take.
Totally thought what she said was incredibly insightful. And I never thought of it from that point of view before. But I bet she is feeling pretty lonely right about now. I think she's just a different puppet, like not the Biden puppet, but the puppet. Yeah, we're going to put her in there, prop her up. If she flies, great. If she doesn't, oh, well, you know, I don't think, well, I mean, it's a pretty ruthless game anyway, but she doesn't have like the cohesive group behind her, but they're willing to just let her go out there and see what happens. If they throw up in the air and see if she can like flap her wings, that's no harm, no foul for them there. So I think that Tulsi is a brilliant move. I always hoped that maybe she would be his vice president for Trump. Not that I don't like JD, but I just thought that would be a nice balance. I think she's very bright. I think she's very measured. I think she's very articulate. I love that he is using her as a resource. I think that there is just a lot there. I don't have butterflies about this debate, William, I have to say. I think Trump has a chest full of ammunition here. And if he can just stay away from a few bombs, you know, he's going to – no, seriously, if he can stay away from a few landmines –
Oh, no, I agree. I'm smiling because I agree. You're absolutely right. But let me put really some butterflies. Let me put some butterflies in your guys' belly.
Okay.
Here. The young vote. It's something Republicans have always lacked. That
yes.
is a 60% to 34% margin in terms of the younger voters. And 11% of young Republicans say they don't care for Trump. How does Trump, because you're right, both of you are right, Trump has the ammunition. How does Trump, President Trump, use that ammunition to woo these young voters? Because them staying at home is a win unto itself. But the ones that come out to woo them to, I am the candidate you really need, not Kamala. What can he do in this debate to make that happen? Or can't he? You know, Annette.
I think he can appear radical. I really do. I think that's a turnoff for the kids. I think there are a lot of people, a lot of conservative kids out there who really believe in, who are patriotic and believe in this country, who believe in our Constitution. I think what has happened is that Trump started to appear radical and that all got into the media. And the way it came out and the way it got flushed out into the media toward the kids, they started to think, oh, is it really a danger? Is he Hitler-esque? They don't want that. They don't want to think that we're going to have someone who wants to be like a dictator type of person. I think that that's all been widely distorted. Hey, but they're kids. And so they don't understand some of that yet, I don't think. I don't think that they see what's really behind it and the bigger things at play. I don't. I think that the
but
kids...
But Annette, they may be yeah. kids, but they can vote. So how
yeah,
does
they
Trump
can.
Get them to vote for him?
By not being, by not going talking about election interference, I don't think that helps them. I don't think that they find it believable. And by not being radical, I don't think he even goes back to January 6th. I don't think that that's a good look for him either. I'm not saying he's wrong. I'm not saying those people should still be in jail. They shouldn't be. But I think that's a lot for the kids to digest. I think he has to be a little bit, not be as Trumpy. And he talk about the things that really, no, that really matter to them because they do believe in this nation. And a lot of them do believe
jobs.
That they want, well, jobs. Okay, I guess I really didn't think about that. But is there a job crisis for the kids?
I mean, what G said, there's a lot of people there. If you're 18, uneducated, you're working McDonald's in the afternoon, security guard at night, you know? So I get what you're saying with the radical. I agree.
Wait,
I guess what I was just saying is
going
to G's point. What's
wait,
that?
I have a question, though. I have an honest question for you. I don't know how many kids you know that are doing double duty on the jobs. I think they're out
there
in Washington.
I'm talking a young voter. I'm talking a young voter. A young voter can be a college kid being supported
yeah.
by the parent at school. A young voter could be a kid at a work living in mama and papa's basement. A young kid, man or young woman may be supporting maybe a single mom, maybe a young couple. So it depends on what demographic, but they're young voters out there getting started in life. And when I say young, the scenarios I just gave, those are people that can be in their early 20s. G, you want to jump in on here? I see you getting ready to say something.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say a couple things. One is, you know, just reference TikTok. I mean, he's been on Twitter for forever, right? And I can't remember what Obama was. He was the first internet president. I think that's true, social media, right? But then Donald Trump was the first Twitter president. But now you got these TikTok shorts. So, I mean, maybe Trump makes a reference to some kind of TikTok video or whatever. And, you know, that might win something with the few the young people that are actually watching the debate. But I think the other thing is, and I think this would be good policy, just in general, but student loan interest is deductible only under a certain income level. I mean, increase that income level. Make it deductible.
I would completely stay away from the student loan thing, but that's free money, and there's no way to win that argument.
No, you know? Not free money. No, they still have to pay back their loan, but just make the interest deductible, right? Because we want more educated kids, so you just make the interest deductible mm-hmm. from the taxes. So if you pay $10,000 in interest, deduct $10,000 for your income, and you pay a little bit of less taxes, right?
No, I mean, you're talking reasonable stuff. I'm talking perception versus reality. The perception
okay, right.
is, hey, Kamala wants to do even away with even more student loans. You know, that's a non-winnable argument for Trump. Doesn't matter.
I see, I see what you're saying.
Student loans, she's going to be, yeah, I don't want y'all to pay it back. I'm going to make sure y'all don't have to pay that back. So if Trump comes, well, I'm going to reduce the interest. He's, I mean, that's a lost battle. My take is just a young voter who is living life and it's affecting them. And they have to go, and they're looking at what the issues are. That's why I say job. The kitchen, I think if Trump sticks to the, what's that saying, the kitchen? The
kitchen sink discussion, conversation.
Yeah. There's a term, a political term. It's like being able to pay the bills, being able to find a job. Because there's a lot of young people who, as you said, Annette, are patriotic, want to work, want to make an easy, an honest living. And that's a separate vote from the kid who's living in the basement or at college. And those kids actually tend to stay home and not vote.
Well, could he, William, still sell the American dream? Do you think that that's something that...
Oh, that is the American dream. Having a job, being able to save money to earn. Because remember, here's what Trump can go back to. I was the only president in memory that had the working wage growing. Most presidents, even in good economies, the working wage does not grow. I had it growing. So, yes, he can do a lot for the – there's a lot of minorities, a lot of young people who are like, yeah, it's your classic conversation I heard as a kid, a black man talking to my father. He worked with my father, says, said to the effect, I'm voting for Reagan because I got more money in my wallet. Now, he didn't have more money in his wallet because he was in the military. You know, he earned X amount. But what he was saying is his money was going farther. And Trump has that based off of his track record. And that is the American dream, to buy a house, to be able to afford a car, to get out of your mama's basement. You know? So that's where his debate team can prep him that way. Because, again, he shouldn't even bother about talking to the kid living in mama's basement playing their Xbox or the college kid. They don't tend to vote anyway, and they don't care because they're not feeling the pains of this economy because mama and papa is covering their pain. And that's a whole other topic for itself. So, guys, G and then Annette, final thoughts on the debate before we close the show out. G.
Next Tuesday will be fun, interesting, and we'll see if it changes the dynamics of the race. I have a feeling it won't, but we'll see what happens.
Miss Annette.
I can't wait. I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be interesting, and I think there's going to be some surprises, and I think I'm feeling really good about it.
Outstanding. My final comment is, G, I think this could change the dynamics of the race only because of how bad Kamala is with the word salad, with when she does show her true beliefs. To me, she's a different form of Joe Biden. Joe Biden, you know, she can be fumbled. She can fumble that quickly. So I think this could be one of those few debates that can move. It could literally ruin her chances. She has more riding on this debate, I think, than Trump does. Trump has his, as Annette said, his Trumpiness to worry about. But with the mics being off, that's 90% of the battle has been won by Trump's team. Hallelujah. Thank you, Joe Biden, for demanding the mics be off for the first debate. And with that, my friends, thank you for tuning in. This is a very long podcast. It was some heavy topics on abortion. We didn't solve the abortion problem, but we had a long discussion as the pros and cons of it. And obviously, it's always fun to talk about debates and the jobs report. G, good job on the jobs report, despite the fact that was depressing. And to everyone, we haven't solidified it, but there's a good chance we come on after the debate to talk some debate outcomes, what our thoughts are, if Trump's Trumpiness got him or if Kamala's word salad got her. So as everybody else, you can find this podcast as well as our Libertarian and our sports podcast at grumblingsmedia.com, as well as our social media platforms such as Rumble, YouTube, Apple, Pandora, Spotify, under the handle Grumblings Media. Thank you for tuning in. And until next time, my friends, I am William Del Pilar. This is Fired Up. I bid you adieu.